This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today in the nation's capital, where Democrats want to fast-track a pandemic relief bill with the second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump slated to begin next week. Joining us now on the line is Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch. Congressman Lynch, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be with you, Tiziana.
Congressman, before we dive in, I just want to wish you well after testing positive for COVID-19 last Friday.
Well, thank you. You're very kind. I actually, this past Saturday, I got a negative test, so that's good. But I still have to complete the protocol. And the docs tell me that's how this is supposed to work. So even though I got the two Pfizer vaccines, the two doses, they protect you from getting sick. They don't protect the virus from infecting you. So I never experienced any symptoms or anything like that. I know the press has, emphasized that I got the vaccine and I still got the virus, but I think that's misinformation. I got the vaccines and I didn't get sick. I got exposed, but I didn't get sick. So this is the way the docs tell me this is the way the vaccine is supposed to work. I just wanted to clear that up.
I do appreciate you clearing that up, and we're actually going to do one of our Ask the Doctor segments later in the hour where we're going to talk specifically about that further, the difference between being vaccinated from getting sick and whether or not you can still catch it. So I appreciate you providing that distinction. There's a lot for us to talk about. Let's dive in. And I want to start by framing up for our listeners. We have this question of the COVID bill. Now, we know President Biden has proposed $1.9 trillion. I mentioned earlier, Democrats are expected to fast track it if they have to. Now we have 10 Republican senators who are proposing a $600 billion bill. A lot of daylight there. Is that just people anchoring hard and you're going to come together and find a solution? Or is there so much daylight there that a fast track is the only way to go?
I'm not really sure what the underpinnings of the Senate proposal is, the 10 Republicans. So I really can't speak to that and what their strategy is. But I do know that we looked very hard at what we need to address the pandemic. And of course, within that basket are, there's the need for schools to reopen in a meaningful way in April or May. There's also funding there for rapid transit. I'm on the Transportation Committee, and we insisted that be included. I also fought very hard to include money for the airline, for airline workers, but also for Logan Airport. You know, it's the 16th largest airport in America. And, they've been trying not to lay people off over there, anticipating that when things get back, they want to be up and running. But so they're in a tough spot right now. And so we've been advocating for them. So there are a lot of things that have been subsumed within our COVID-19 relief bill that are very, very essential. And so, when they come up with a counteroffer of $600 billion, we look at our package and say, okay, we're going to have to do triage here. Where do we start? And all of this is very essential. So it makes it very difficult for us to look and say, okay, who's going to go without? There is a little bit of wiggle room here. So, for instance, in our bill, in the president's proposal, we anticipated let's give everybody unemployment benefits until September, right? That'll be safe. The Senate proposal is saying, well, let's do it till June. Maybe there's some wiggle room there that we could, split on July. And one thought is, let's make this conditional. Let's make it till June. And then if unemployment is still over a certain amount, then we will extend the benefits. That's another, a condition-based alternative. So we're looking at ways to get to yes, but we are far apart.
So I'm keyed in on you saying we're looking at ways to get to yes. I know you're aware that there's a public conversation about Democrats going it on their own here and Republican pushback that if that happens, it undermines Joe Biden's commitment to unity, bipartisanship. At the same time, we hear a lot of legislators saying we need more money than $600 billion. It sounds like you think there should be a priority to try to find a middle ground and get a bill passed in a bipartisan way. Am I hearing you correctly?
Not really, because this is This has to happen, right? So this, we're talking, you know, American lives here. So we will not stand on. I mean, it would be nice if it was bipartisan, and I think we owe the American people the hope of doing something, and I think it would be very good for the Biden administration going forward and our relationship with some of our Republican colleagues if we could go forward together. However, this has to get done. And so I'm hell or high water. If it has to rely on Democratic votes alone, then that's the way it's going to be. But this has to go. So, you know, we're negotiating in good faith, but at the end of the day, we've got to save the American people, right? And we've got to get the economy back in line, and we're trying to make up for lost time because the previous administration did not take this seriously.
I'm noticing that phrase in good faith. That makes me think of another question I want to ask you, which is about this second impeachment trial for former President Donald Trump next week. Again, aware that five Republican senators were the only ones who even voted to proceed with the impeachment. You know, lots of commentary that foreshadows how many are likely to vote to convict in that trial. So is this a meaningful act with that kind of seemingly visible lack of support among half the Senate? Or is this a ceremonial thing that you think has to be done on this path to accountability?
Well, it's meaningful in the sense that I took an oath to protect and defend the Constitution. And so I meant those words when I said them. And you know, that the vote to impeach is entirely consistent and is based on my pledge, my oath to defend the Constitution. So, we don't have to go into the long litany of reasons that Donald Trump should be impeached again. He ordered a violent attack on the Capitol. You know, he lied about the election. I guess he's not saying that anymore in his latest brief before the Senate. But he did do that extensively, and there were Republicans that supported him. So, you know, he needs to be impeached. He needs to be impeached and convicted.
Is there any? Is there any worry, though, that if he is not convicted, that allows the former president to say, I was found not guilty. See, I didn't do anything wrong.
Well, basing my conduct on what he's going to say is just not well-founded, right? Because if we didn't impeach him, if we pulled back, he would say, see, they didn't impeach me. They knew they were wrong. I mean, you can't, the man's a lunatic. So you really can't base your conduct on what he's doing. And he's a pathological liar. So, you know, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole to try to reconcile my conduct and my decisions with what Donald Trump might say. That just can't happen.
So I hear your point there. And it again, makes me think of another question I want to ask you, which is a question about conduct in the House. I know you know about Marjorie Taylor Greene, one of your colleagues in the House, who has come under fire for some really extreme beliefs and comments and supporting things like suggestions that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi ought to be killed, that the Parkland shooting was a false flag operation. I know your colleague in the Massachusetts delegation, Jim McGovern, the Rules Committee are going to take up a question about her tomorrow, about stripping her of committee appointments. Given this oath that House members take and what you just said about being accountable for your own conduct, what do you believe is the appropriate way to handle the Marjorie Taylor Greene situation?
Well, I've actually signed on to the resolution as a co-sponsor to have her removed from those committees. I think Ms. Wasserman Schultz is the lead on that. But there's also the bigger question about expulsion. And so I know Mr. Gomez on our committee is circulating a letter, you know, a sense of Congress and dear colleague letter, just to sound out members. But I think the Ethics Committee and also there's an ongoing investigation, right, about the attacks on the Capitol and what members said what and what actions were taken, if any, on their part to assist and abet the insurrectionists. So when we get all that information together, we're going to have to figure out, whether expulsion is appropriate. And not only for her, but there may be others, right? We're letting the FBI do their job right now, and that includes, you know, the messaging, the social media, as well as, the videotapes of the Capitol complex from the 4th through the 8th of January. So, if there's aid and abetting being done by members of Congress to put their colleagues at risk and in support of a violent insurrection, then I believe they would have to be expelled as well. So we're trying to weigh that. We're trying to categorize our colleagues in terms of whether they merely voted, you know, against confirming the results of the election, or whether they were actively involved in the insurrection effort to interfere in the Electoral College count. So,
This really, it's a remarkable conversation we're having. You're talking about the potential of having to look at expelling colleagues. We had the newest member of the Massachusetts delegation, Jake Auchincloss, on last week. He said his first Wednesday was an insurrection. His second Wednesday was an impeachment. His third Wednesday was an inauguration. Have you ever seen anything like this in your 20 years in Congress?
Never. Nothing that even comes close. I mean, this is really, you know, it shakes the very foundations of our government. Things that I took for granted for so long, that you grow up with, the faith that you have in our system of government, and then to realize how terribly fragile all of this is, that threat on January 6th was an existential threat to our system of government and the peaceful transfer of power that forever we have taken for granted. So, no, I haven't seen anything like this. This would be a challenging time anyway, you know, put aside the insurrection, the attack on the Capitol, put aside the pandemic. Just the slate of issues that we're confronting right now is daunting. And then to pile on the fact that, you know, they're attacking the Capitol and we're in the middle of a pandemic just makes our work that much harder.
What is the imperative to you? What are you doubling down on as a result?
Well, you know, we're trying to take things one step at a time. We're trying to be thorough and thoughtful. But there is that broader relationship. I consider myself a moderate Democrat. I've tried throughout my 20 years to work across the aisle with my Republican colleagues. But I have to say, over the last 4 to 6 years, many of them have decided not to run for reelection or they've been defeated by extremists within their own party. So those opportunities are dwindling. And now we really have to look very closely at what my colleagues did to undermine the outcome of the election, to undermine the legitimacy of our democratic elections, foster rebellion against the government. So, you know, we're all doing some soul searching, and we've had long conversations in the Democratic caucus and in my committees to talk about whether we can even, you know, work with people to co-sponsor bills, which used to be, you know, it used to be a badge of honor or a measure of credibility if you could get people from the other party to come onto your bill and support you. And that was really, you know, that that was about relationships, about, you know, I travel an awful lot, Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Mali, and I always had Republican members with me. That's how you build relationships. You know their families, you know them, you know what their districts are like, you know what their challenges are, and you build relationships. But that's all been blown up. I really have to say that has changed the relationship for those members. And there are those who did not embrace any of that rebellious conduct, and who shut up. Maybe they didn't speak out as loudly as we would like, but they didn't partake. So there's a real fundamental reassessment of our relationship with our Republican colleagues and how we move forward.
That is Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch. I appreciate you joining us. Thank you.
Thank you, Tiziana.
And in a few minutes, we will start taking your COVID-19 vaccine and pandemic questions. You can start queuing up at 1-800-423-8255. But before we turn to that panel, we want to go to Roxbury Community College, where earlier this afternoon, a mass vaccination site opened at the Reggie Lewis Track and Athletic Center. Now, yesterday's snowstorm delayed the opening by one day. But Boston Mayor Marty Walsh says the city expects to initially administer about 1,000 vaccines a week there. The Commonwealth is eventually slated to take over the site and scale it up further. Valerie Robertson is president of Roxbury Community College and joins us on the line now. President Robertson, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
So take us there today. Is it busy? What should folks expect if they arrive for an appointment?
So at this point, it's not busy yet, but I think that most individuals can be served right away when they come in for their appointment, and we're happy to have them on campus.
And are you and the college actively helping manage this program, or is it more a matter of lending space? How are you engaged with it?
So we are lending space to the efforts. We're not involved in the management.
So I understand that you are mostly still offering remote learning at Roxbury Community College. And I got to thinking, would this work if you were holding in-person classes, or is this kind of a strange silver lining of the moment we're in, that the Reggie Lewis Center could be used in this way at this moment?
This is a strange silver lining, and we're actually grateful to be able to lend the space to these efforts. We know that many of our students will be able to take advantage of it, and this is the thing that's in the way of us returning to full in-person classes. So we're really looking forward to our students and members of the community getting their vaccine and allowing us to get back to normal.
So I'm assuming most of your students would be vaccinated in phase 3. The original plan calls for that to start around the April timeframe. Sounds like you believe this center will be serving as a vaccination site for a significant chunk of time this year.
We do. We think that it's going to last at least through the early summer months. And I do think, though, that many of our students will qualify for some of the earlier phases. Our average age is 30. And so we know that many of our students are working in essential jobs throughout the Commonwealth. So I expect that some of them will be in the earlier phases. We also have a number of students, because we, not just our traditional classes, but we have classes for older adults like our sensational seniors. I know that there are a couple of women in that class that are in their 80s. I expect that they will be among the first to get the vaccines early this month.
You know, last time we had you on air, you reminded us that Roxbury Community College's students are predominantly people of color. When Suffolk University and the Boston Globe asked community members if they'd get the vaccine as soon as possible, only 11% of Black respondents and 32% of Latino respondents said yes. Do you feel like the trusted brand of Roxbury Community College and being able to go there for a vaccination may increase the likelihood of communities of color in Boston going in and getting vaccinated?
I certainly hope so. And I mean, that was part of the reason why we were anxious to say yes when the city approached us for the space. We really felt like this is a place that members of the community already have a level of comfort. There are so many things that happen at the Reggie, everything from comic book festivals to vegetarian fairs, job fairs. And so members of the community generally have a good feeling about coming to the Reggie. So we hope that this is going to encourage more people from the Black and Brown community to feel safe and secure in that trusted environment.
You said a minute ago that this is the path to bringing students back to campus. And when we did talk last time, we talked about how hard the pandemic has been on your student body. How, 6 months later, how are they doing? And is there a student on your mind who kind of embodies the experience that your young people are having right now?
Yeah, there are a few students that really come to mind. You know, we have merit-based scholarships available for students. And we had one student who didn't take advantage of her scholarship, and we called to talk to her a little bit about why. And she said that her experience in trying to balance her children's work, her own work, in a remote environment was really tough, and she didn't do as well as she would have liked to. So she's obviously an honor student because she's getting that honor scholarship. And she said because of that experience, she did not want to jeopardize her GPA by taking advantage of the scholarship in the spring semester because she didn't do as well as she would have hoped in balancing that. And I think that, you know, many of our students unfortunately had to make the decision not to attend classes the spring semester. And I think that there are even more students that have really just kind of opted out for this full year. So as I think about getting students back to school, I'm just encouraging them again to get the vaccine so that we can keep them on the path towards finishing their degrees. And for many of our students, this is the thing that's standing in the way of employment. And so it's very important for them to be able to not get behind and really, you know, as I said, take that vaccine and come back to class.
That is Valerie Robertson, president of Roxbury Community College, where today another vaccine clinic has opened. President Robertson, thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So let's turn now to our panel of health professionals and the opportunity for you to ask questions. Again, the number is 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us this week is Dr. Shira Derone. She is an infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. And Lenny Marcus, who is the founding co-director of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative, which is a joint program of the Harvard Chan School of Public Health and the Kennedy School of Government. Dr. Derone is here to help with your medical questions. Lenny Marcus can help with what you need to understand about the vaccine rollout and strategy. We welcome you both back, Dr. Derone, Lenny. Thanks for being here.
Great to be
Thank
back.
You. Thank you.
So I want to note, we already have calls in queue, but I do want to ask you guys a couple of questions first before our listeners join in. Dr. Derone, how important is it in your view to ramp up sites like the Reggie Lewis Center? I know you heard the conversation we just had with President Valerie Robertson.
I think there's no speed with which the vaccine could be rolled out that I would be satisfied with. I mean, I'm impressed with all of the work. I don't want to disparage anyone's efforts because everyone is working day and night to do it. But we just have to go as fast as humanly possible here. We're really trying to outrun the pandemic and especially these new variants that we're so worried about.
It is scary, Dr. Derone, to think about how fast we have to run to do that outrunning. God, I hate to ask you this, but are you optimistic? Can we do it?
I try to be optimistic. I've been trying to be or not be a doom and gloom person for the last year now. I have to be optimistic.
And Lenny Marcus, Dr. Derone, you know, did not want to impugn anyone, just said everyone's working really, really hard. But we are not ranked highly. According to Bloomberg, more than 40 states and D.C. are ahead of us in terms of the rollout. How would you rate our handling overall of the vaccine rollout so far?
Well, watching what we're seeing here in Massachusetts, you have to look at that in two different perspectives. One of them is leadership. What is the intention here in the state? And certainly in the state over the course of this last year has provided leadership in handling the COVID-19 crisis. And it's perplexing to see that same approach not being accomplished with the rollout of vaccines. And it does appear that there have been problems in logistics and planning and boots on the ground. So I was very happy to hear what's being done by Dr. Roberson at the Roxbury Community College. Glad to see what's being done at the Gillette Center, at Fenway Park. And we need the state to do two things. One, to ramp up the logistics and the operations on the ground right now. But I think there's an important lesson here. What we see right now in the rates of vaccination are small compared to what we hope to see in March, April, and May. So now's the time to plan and get ready for those logistical arrangements. Use some of the bumps that we've seen now in this state and in other states to learn the lessons to ensure that going forward, they're not repeated.
All right, let's just jump right into calls here then. 800-423-8255. We've got Wenda on the line from Chelsea. Wenda, what's your question?
I have a question about comorbidities. I have asthma, and when I go to the CDC website to look up where that falls in terms of comorbidities, it's sort of in a second-tier category, as far as I can tell, of, you know, increased risk at contracting severe COVID. And I'm just not sure where that falls in the parameters of receiving the vaccine in terms of the phases. Does that make sense?
So let's ask, yes, it does. Let's ask Dr. Shira Doron if she's able to help answer that question.
Yeah, so in the grand scheme of things, in terms of underlying disease risk, asthma is sort of a relatively kind of low on the risk scale compared to certain other things like cardiovascular disease and diabetes. You know, this next phase is going to include people with two comorbidities. So if you're not in an age group and you only have asthma, you know, you're going to be further down the line. I don't have the Massachusetts specific list of comorbidities up in front of me right now. So I don't know whether asthma is on the list in terms of if you had something else in addition, whether that would qualify you for this next, the phase that comes after the 75-year-olds.
And I do believe, Wenda, you know, as we let you go there, Wenda, I do believe that the governor said this week that they are working to improve the state's website to actually take you through sort of the heuristics to figure out if you qualify. So hopefully that is going to get easier to do on the state's website as well. Let's pick up another call here. We've got Beverly in Watertown at 1-800-423-8255. Beverly, go ahead.
I have a public health type question rather than medical. My career was in public health before I retired, and what I'm concerned about is the messaging that people are getting now in terms of how the numbers, you know, number of cases, you know, mortality, et cetera, is going down. And also in our state, some restrictions are being lessened, not lifted, but, you know, not has been being scaled back. What I'm concerned about is that this is precisely the context in which people say, like, oh, wow, it's not as bad out here as it was. I can sort of, you know, slow down. I can kind of relax. And there we are again facing not only the original variant or whatever variant we're on now, but these other variants that have been discovered from other countries.
So, Beverly, I appreciate the call in raising this trade-off about between loosening things and then finding ourselves in that cycle where then we get sucked back into a worse situation with cases. Lenny Marcus, this is a public health question. It's in your sweet spot. What's your reaction to Beverly?
So first off, Beverly, thank you for all of your work in public health. We need what you've been doing more now than ever before. And this is a dilemma for politicians across the country. On one hand, we do want to open the economy. We want people to have those opportunities to get back to work, to get back to being able to go to a restaurant or other activities, and we have to remain vigilant. I think in the public health community, there has been concern, just as Beverly mentioned, that we send a message when businesses start opening up, when we begin to loosen some of these restrictions. And this is particularly of concern because this is not just another reduction in the numbers. The numbers are going down post the holiday surge. Just as those numbers are going down, we see another threat. And the variants clearly are in Massachusetts. They're more infectious, they're more deadly, and we have to be more alert right now. As Dr. Durone said earlier, this is a race against time. And that's why moving forward on this vaccination program is so important right now, simply because the threat from these variants continues to hit us. And the longer that the virus is circulating in the community, the more likely that there will be additional variants that could hit us down the road.
So, Dr. Durone, I want to turn back to you based on what Lenny Marcus just said. We had Dr. Dan Baruch on the show yesterday. He's the lead in developing the forthcoming Johnson & Johnson vaccine. I'm sure you've heard that it has shown in trials to be 66% effective. Moderna and Pfizer were in the 90s, but he told us yesterday that that was apples to oranges because the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was trialed with these new, more contagious variants in the mix where the other two weren't. So for those who might be confused about comparing efficacy of the vaccines and what it means to have these variants in the mix, can you react to what he said yesterday and explain that any further for us?
Sure. I mean, the bottom line is if you're offered a vaccine, take it. They are all excellent vaccines, and we need people to take whichever one is offered to them first. You cannot compare the numbers that you're seeing from the J&J trial to the numbers that we saw with the mRNA vaccines. And the bottom line is that the J&J vaccine does what it's intended to do. It prevents severe disease. And after full immunity was reached, there were actually no cases of hospitalization or death. And that's what's important.
And this idea that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, if approved for emergency use in the United States, would become the third vaccine, but it would be single dose and wouldn't require the same type of storage freezer storage and therefore challenging distribution. Could it really help us speed up and scale up the rate at which we achieve some kind of herd immunity, Dr. Durone?
It could be a game changer if the supply can keep up with the demand. The idea that it could we could have a vaccine that's being given out in doctor's offices, in every pharmacy, really it would look just like the flu vaccine in terms of distribution. It could be done in schools, anywhere. That would be so critical to really getting this into all the arms that need it.
Let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255. I've got Tracy on the line in Newton. Tracy, go ahead.
Hi, I work in an animal clinic, and at the CDC guideline, anyone at the veterinary hospital are considered as like 1B in the phase 1B for the vaccine. But in Massachusetts, we are considered as phase 3. Will there be any adjustment regarding that? Because we actually work day to day, and we work with clients and their animals.
Thank you for that, Tracy. And Tracy, your sound was a little off, so I'm just going to repeat it and then ask Lenny Marcus to weigh in. CDC guidelines we do know that the CDC advisory committee had veterinarians, people in animal services in phase 1B. They are in phase 3 currently in Massachusetts. Lenny Marcus, there are a lot of professions asking to be moved up right now in the sequence of priority in Massachusetts phases. How does that work, and should that be possible to do to get these changes made as we go along?
We live in a federal government system where the CDC did make those recommendations, and it's up to the states to decide how they're going to be rolled out in each state. So what we're finding is different states are coming up with different priorities, and that's the way the system is working. what we're finding now, 2 weeks into the new administration, that this relationship between states and the federal government, they're beginning to change. But up to this point, Massachusetts will be distributing the vaccines based on the criteria that they've established here.
All right, let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255. We've got Celia on the line from Brookline. Celia, what's your question?
Thank you for taking my phone call. I'm 87 years old, and I want to know where can I go to get the vaccine. I have not been able to find a place.
Okay, Celia, thank you for that question. Dr. Derone, we have heard from so many people age 75 or older over the last week with that same question and frustration about how do I get my appointment? Where do I go? What advice do you have for Celia?
I'm so frustrated for you. Our patients are struggling to get in as well. I would tell you that things are ramping up. Hospitals just came online yesterday giving vaccinations to their patients. If you're a patient at any hospital, if you've ever been a patient at a hospital, I would suggest that you reach out to that hospital to see what they are doing. For those who are over 75, the governor's administration promised there would be a telephone hotline to provide telephone assistance in getting on the schedule for vaccination. So I think that easier times are coming. It just hasn't been fast enough.
And I want to echo what Dr. Derone just said. And Celia, hope that you're able to get a vaccination soon. And here, this is a message to the governor and to the state. These logistical problems have to be identified right now so that people can get on a website, get the information that they need, get their questions answered. We've got to set up these clinics, and this has to be done through contracting with the types of people and organizations who can set these systems up very quickly. So what we're seeing, we're thrilled to see David McGilvray, who was in charge of the Boston Marathon, now in charge of the Fenway Park operation. It's those sorts of people, those sorts of operations that need to be stood up quickly so that Celia and others are able to know where to go, where to get information, and to get vaccinations as soon as possible.
And just one more thing for Celia, this hotline is expected to be a callback system. And Governor Baker said that they did expect it to launch this week. As soon as that hotline is up, we will put it on our website and we will make sure to talk about it on our show. So keep listening and you can look for it at radioboston.org. Once that hotline is up, we'll get the number out there too. We do hear your frustration. So I want to ask the two of you before we wrap about a piece of news today. NPR and Political are reporting today that the Biden administration next week is going to start shipping 1 million vaccine doses directly to retail pharmacies. This is in addition to those sent to the states. And they say they're doing it explicitly to improve equity access. That is striking that they're going to give more out. It's going to go to the for-profit sector because they're feeling like the states are not getting equity access done well enough. And I just want to quickly get your reactions to that. Dr. Derone.
Well, I mean, my reaction is that more vaccine in more places is a good thing. And people are accustomed to going to their local retail pharmacy, much more so than going to, you know, a stadium. So I think that's a good thing.
And Lenny Marcus, with less than a minute left, how about your reactions?
I agree. It is a good thing. These are businesses that are designed to give people medications. They're designed to work with the public. Those are the people that you want to be doing this. So I see this as a plus.
Well, and I was being such a good girl on the clock and realized we have just a touch more time left, actually. So I'm going to come back to you, Dr. Derone. I was making sure we managed it. Dr. Derone, just your parting thought for people today. You know, this is a long haul. Your parting thought for them.
These are scary times. The disease has been scary, and I have to acknowledge that the vaccine is scary. It feels like it was put out there very quickly. I want to reassure everyone that I've gotten my two doses because I trust the science and the FDA process, and I believe that everyone should be vaccinated.
All right. That is Dr. Shira Derone, an infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center, and Lenny Marcus, who's the founding co-director of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative at Harvard. Thanks to both of you for answering caller questions today. Really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. We're going to go to a break. When we come back, a play, Cato and Dolly, which explores the lives of people in first Massachusetts Governor John Hancock's household. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. John Hancock is most known for that large signature on the Declaration of Independence. And to his credit, the first governor of Massachusetts and the president of the Second Continental Congress, he did play a major role in the formation of the United States. But Cato and Dolly, a new American play, celebrates instead the people around him who helped make all that happen. His wife, Dolly Hancock, and Cato, an enslaved man in his household. The inspiration for the play was the actual front door of the Hancock House, which was preserved after the Hancock Mansion was torn down in 1863. It was originally performed in front of that door at the old State House, but starting February 12th, it'll be brought back as a live stream event. So we are going to revisit our conversation with the playwright, Patrick Gaybridge, the producing artistic director of Plays in Place, which is a theater company focused on these site-specific productions. When WBUR's Jamie Bologna spoke with him in 2018, he told us about the people behind this story.
So Cato Hancock was a man who was enslaved in the John Hancock household. When they came to me and said, you know, we want to write a play that's centered around this door from the Hancock household, trying to figure out who are the people that lived in that household, and we're trying to tell some forgotten stories. So Cato Hancock, we don't know a lot about him, but we knew enough about him to know where he was married, we know where his children were baptized, and we think we know where he died. And he's also referenced in a number of letters from John Hancock, so we kind of know some times when he's in the household, and he's also referenced in the wills of Thomas and Lydia Hancock, who were John Hancock's aunt and uncle.
So you did a little archival dig on Cato.
We did a big archival dig on Cato. And it was a lot of combing through the record to kind of figure out, well, who are the people that were there that we can know enough about to sketch out a story that who we haven't heard about a lot.
And did we know more about Dolly?
We know a little bit more about Dolly, which is odd because that we don't know more of her because she was kind of the first lady of Massachusetts. John Hancock was the first governor of Massachusetts. And she was also active when John Hancock was presiding over the Continental Congress. But her writings didn't tend to survive. He wrote to her a lot of times telling her, how come you never write to me? What was interesting was we started finding out things that we didn't know or that kind of tended to get overlooked in the historical record about her. So it is interesting that she was there helping him out socially during the Continental Congress. So while they're drafting the Declaration of Independence, she's there serving as social hostess and everything while she's also pregnant.
Wow. So she's almost directly involved with his work there.
She was definitely directly involved with his work. There was not a lot of money in the Continental Congress at that time. So their wives would help them. Like she would stay up late into the night helping him sign papers. There were a lot of papers to sign during the Continental Congress.
And you said, again, while pregnant. I mean,
right.
is that typical of the time? I mean, were their lives typical of women and enslaved people at the time?
I think what's interesting is that when you see history books written, as they traditionally have been, by white men, the details of people's lives sometimes tend to get overlooked. And so women's roles are overlooked, but also kind of the elements of their lives. So when they're pregnant, or in her case, she loses two children during the war years, essentially, and slightly after the war years. And so trying to understand, you know, what did that mean? And she loses two children and two husbands in the course of her lives. And so what does that mean? What does it mean to be surviving in that kind of household?
And so in thinking about these ideas, did you take a lot of artistic licenses in creating this story?
I had to take some for sure because, again, their voices are not well recorded. So I'm trying to understand how they relate to each other. And both could have been in the household for a long time. We know Cato was in the household from when he was a boy until he was freed at age 30 by Thomas Hancock's will. And then we know he stays beyond that, which is kind of interesting. So he's a slave in the household, and then he remains working there as a servant.
Right, he becomes their servant. And then at one point he speaks of missing working and living in their home. And I guess I'm curious about that sort of more positive portrayal of this relationship. I mean, he was enslaved by the Hancocks. Is this true to history?
We don't know exactly how he felt about it, but what we do know is that he had limited options in North America at that time. Because we think, a lot of times we think about slavery as kind of the antebellum period and the Southern slavery model of plantation slavery and house slaves. But New England slavery was very different. And also in this period, so slavery ends in Massachusetts in the early 1780s. But so in this period, when he's a slave in the 1760s and 1770s, there's nowhere for him to go when he's freed.
Mm-hmm.
So instead, he has to think about how he's going to align himself with people who can protect him. And he happens to be working for the richest man in Boston in the most powerful household.
Huh. I want to ask you about your process of telling this story. You're telling this story of a woman and a person of color who's enslaved. What was that process like for you?
I definitely understand that it's a challenge for me. And I write about race a lot in my work. I come from a mixed race family. So issues of race are really important for me to explore to kind of understand my own family. But I think we definitely thought about it a lot, the whole team, and trying to make sure it's just so hard because you don't want to underplay the fact that he was a slave and slavery is terrible. At the same time, he makes a decision to stay. So try to understand why that is and try to understand how households worked. Trying to understand who protects you and who do you protect. Those situations of power are really important.
Right.
And so trying to get that and trying to constantly challenge my lens and think about and, you know, working with the actors and director to bring other points of view too.
I also want to ask you about this idea of looking back at history. There are conversations throughout the city and the country on renaming things, and just around the corner from the old State House is Faneuil Hall, which some activists have called upon the city to rename because its namesake, Peter Faneuil, made money off of slavery and he was a slave owner himself. How do you think this play fits into the reexamination of history and the conversations that we're having right now as a city?
I think the key thing about useful elements of a play like this is it shows the complexity of the questions that we're asking and the question and the complexity of lives at that time period. These are not easy things to figure out. And these were real human beings who had to make really, really hard choices in the situations that they were in. And again, this isn't a play about John Hancock. He figures in, but we made a very conscious decision to have a play with only two actors, a man and a woman. So those two people play everything. So John Hancock is often played by a woman. So we're moving across race and gender in the roles that we're playing. And that also helps change and shift the conversation a little bit to make sure we're thinking about how do we approach these as people? How can we shift our lenses?
Well, so finally, I wanted to ask you about that. What do you hope people who come and see this 24-minute play, as you call it, what do you hope they take away from it?
I think someone was facilitating a discussion for us, and she said, you know, before I saw this play, if I'd walked into this room, I would have said, oh, nice door, and then walked away. And instead, now when they walk in, they think, oh, this door has seen a lot of things, and where these were real people with really complicated lives and relationships. And that's what we need to understand about history, is that it's not simple. And anytime we flatten out history, we don't really understand enough to ask the right questions today. So if we can answer the right questions about the past, we can understand the present much better.
That's WBUR's Jamie Bologna speaking with playwright Patrick Gaybridge in 2018. He is the producing artistic director of Plays in Place, a theater company focused on site-specific productions. His play, Cato and Dolly, a new American play, will be live streaming four times over the next 2 months, beginning on February 12th. For more information, you can visit our website, radioboston.org.